So I would say the first reference who introduced first finite temperature insulators was Kagan and Maksimov about 25, 28 years ago. And the physics argument was pretty much the same, though the physics system was slightly different. It was helium-3 solution and solid helium-4. But the same arguments lead to the statement that you have finite temperature insulator. And later on, the same arguments were used, I'm sorry, by Alena, Altschuler, and Jorah today. So I think Kagan and Maksimov should be mentioned first in the discussion of the topic. So my today's topic will be about very long problem, what happens to dirty bosons. Almost entirely, I will be talking about zero temperature. So there have been some controversy, but I think ultimately we more or less understand what happens for interacting bosons on a lattice or off the lattice if you have weakly interacting boson gas in any dimension. At least we can make some sufficiently rigorous statements. Do you have a laser pointer? Oh, this one? Oh, okay. So let me first thank my collaborators, Boris Svistunov, Lode Pale, Matthias Troy, and Victor Gurari. I also did some work with the Trento group, Stefano Giorgini, and Sebastiano Pilati, who I will mention at the very end. So let me first mention how it will go. I will first concentrate and probably spend most of the time, very slowly, on a couple of slides, just trying to argue that while there is a theorem which actually applies to phase transitions in disordered system, no matter what is the system and no matter what is the dimension. So it's the conclusions of this theorem are equally valid for bosons, fermions, spins in any dimension of space. And then you will see that from this theorem, which I believe is rigorous, you can make some statements about the problem, which was my prime interest, which is superfluid Bose or Mott glass transition and then Mott insulated transition, which states that, well, it's not possible to have a direct transition between superfluid and Mott insulated. It's forbidden. So some intermediate phase has to appear in the middle. So it's not the question of the model or the dimensionality or disorder. So it will happen always. And then I will discuss a couple of mechanisms, trying to see, okay, well, whether we can understand what is implied by the theorem using more microscopic physics. At least, while you can argue that maybe from Harris criterion and vortex phase mechanisms, you can explain what's happening in dimensions 1 and 2, but not in higher dimensions, which means in 3D, we did rely on numerical simulations just to construct the full phase diagram. But some of the features of phase diagram, I would say, we don't understand them theoretically because the mechanisms which we understand in 1D and 2D, they don't apply to 3D. Well, the theorem still applies. And at the very end, I'll probably mention one puzzle about the weakly interacting Bose gas, which essentially tells that we have no idea, theoretically, how to calculate critical temperature of the weakly interacting Bose gas with disorder. So the theorem of inclusions, okay, I need only one statement, which I believe everybody will agree. But if we agree on this statement, then well, the rest will follow more or less naturally. Well, that's why, well, somebody asked me, okay, what if I do it in infinite dimensions? Infinite dimensions will change the first statement. In infinite dimensions, I'll need infinite number. And if you have infinite number and they are all smaller than one, then probably you have zero. So for infinite dimensions, this doesn't apply. So, but well, for any finite number of dimensions, this is true.
Finite in this case means non-infinite or non-zero?
Finite means not infinite. So let me start first with the definition of what I mean by generic disorder. By generic disorder, I will mean any probability distribution of having a random number in some Hamiltonian parameter within the bounds. Because if bounds are actually from minus to plus infinity, some of the phases simply do not exist. So it's important to have a bound at least to discuss, say, Mott insulator. So if I have bounds, I'm allowed to have any distribution function you want. So formally, it's kind of infinite dimensional vector space of those functions. So take any of them. But I want this function to be, when I say generic, it means that any value of disorder can be generated with non-zero probability. And that's why I need the previous lemma. Well, it doesn't matter how small, but it has to be finite. So anywhere within the interval, I have finite. No, here I just mean.
Non-zero.
Yeah, okay. But I didn't use finite in this context. I didn't say the word finite. I said it before, but I am not saying it here. It's non-zero probability anywhere on the interval. And now you can make the following statement. So if you have some transition, no matter what is the phase A and phase B, so you change phase A for phase B as a function of the bound, delta. And if the position of this bound depends on the model of disorder, because I can play different disorder distributions. One can have very small dispersion and peaked around zero. The other one have huge dispersion, say peaked close to the edges. The other one can be uniform. So if the position of delta C changes as a function of the model of disorder, then the following statement is true. So there will exist arbitrarily large, though rare, inclusions of phase A in B and inclusions of phase B in A, which means the statement is symmetric. It will work both ways. So just, well, it's not just applicable for one phase that you can find the competing phase in phase B. It will also work in the opposite direction as well. So that's the important statement of the theorem. So let me just prove it, how it works. Well, suppose you have a transition from A to B as you increase the disorder bound. Well, imagine, well, I will say, okay, suppose this is my model of disorder which I study. Can be spectral potential, just anything. So if I'm sitting in phase B, you say, okay, the typical disorder distribution is, say, given by this function within this bound. But I'm always allowed to create a finite region, in the mentioned sense, finite region, no matter how large, but it's still finite, such that, well, inside this region, the disorder distribution will look exactly the same, but with a smaller bound. Well, I'm right now sitting at a high bound, so I'm always allowed to fluctuate in any given region. The probability can be exponentially small, but I'm allowed to do so. So in this region, I will mimic properties of phase A. And it's a bulk effect. So inside this region, I do think I am in phase A, except for the boundary between A and B. This will look like a phase A, because I can fluctuate to such a region. But in this case, well, kind of the proof is kind of trivial. Well, now you want to prove the opposite. Now I'm sitting in phase A, and somehow I have to produce a big region which looks like B, but B corresponds to a bigger bound. Well, now that's exactly where the condition of the theorem comes in, which says that delta, the critical value of delta, has some dependence on the model of disorder. So if it was weaker disorder, maybe you need a bigger bound. If it's stronger disorder dispersion, maybe you need a smaller bound. Remember, this is infinite dimensional parameter space. What kind of functions you play, you also have correlations on the same side, correlations on nearest neighbor sides. Again, infinite number of such correlations. You have two body, three body, five body correlations. It's an infinite dimensional space, and I need only one slope in any of the infinite dimensions. So once I have the slope, I immediately see that, well, starting from A, I can fluctuate here using finite slope. And in this region, I'll generate a different model of disorder with smaller bound, because, well, you see, I'm just going retreating back a little bit. And this is phase B. So which means inside A, I can also find B. Not only in B I find A, but also in A I can find B. It's not the question of how frequently. It's extremely rare, but, well, I'll still find such regions. So that's the statement of the theorem of inclusions, and probably I'll just mention it in connection with later discussion of compressibility of the Bose glass, that, well, you see here, even if I generate this region, I can actually just imagine that this is disorder in the chemical potential. I can shuffle the global chemical potential of this region back and forth within the boundary and the boundary and the disorder bound which I have for A. So within those, within this limit, I can actually shuffle the position of this point. So if I create this disorder distribution which is mimicking B, I can shift the chemical potential in a finite window. And that's important just to generate a finite density of states. Later on, this will be for a discussion of the compressibility of the Bose glass. But that's what we have. And I say, well, okay, this is exact statement as it appears here, and I don't have to say anything except just, well, the probabilities of generating such regions are finite, but I have to play in a bigger parameter space. I have to consider that I can fluctuate not only in terms of bound, I can also fluctuate in terms of the function which I have for the disorder distribution. Well, it can be also in terms of correlations between the sides, just anything you can imagine about different models of disorder. Okay, now what will be consequences? Well, this is only first part of the theorem, so I'll switch to the second. So what are consequences if this is true? Well, if you do have such a line, then you cannot make a transition from fully gapped state to the gapless state. Well, because why? Because if this is, for example, fully gapped state, So if it's fully gapped state, I can find arbitrary large, though rare, but arbitrary large region of gapless state inside B, so B cannot be gapful. When I say gapful, it means ground state, and for any excitation of any kind, you have to pay finite energy. So I immediately see that, well, if this is the case, you may not have a transition between the fully gapped state and gapless state. It's forbidden. Both of them has to be either fully gapped or both have to be gapless. So that's the implication of this theorem. But then you say, okay, well, obviously, if I take a Mott insulator, I add disorder, sooner or later, this Mott insulator will vanish. And then you immediately understand, okay, well, the consequence is it cannot happen through the line which has some slope. If the line had a slope and you go from, say, Mott insulator to something else, which is gapless, it cannot be a line, because otherwise Mott insulator would be already gapless, so it's not a Mott insulator. So you may not have a transition from fully gapped state according to this scenario. So the only possibility left is to say that the line is absolutely vertical, and no matter what kind of model of disorder you have, no matter how strongly you modify your function from uniform to sharply peaked, double peaked, you introduce correlations between nearest neighbor sites, I can make a model when this is almost, I know, 99999 and this is 10 minus 7. And if you generate 0, you have to generate this 0 for 1 meter afterwards. This model will have exactly the same position for the critical point. So that's what you mean by the vertical line. It has to be in the infinite dimensional space. So that's the second possibility, and you ask, okay, how this can happen? And this happens because, well, that's exactly where I need the definition of generic disorder. Why this is happening? This is happening because all I want from all different models, I want only one thing from them, non-zero probability to generate a certain regular field which destroys the gap. So for whatever reason, you have a transition between A and B. It's not driven by microscopic physics of a given disorder distribution. It's given by the possibility of creating extremely rare statistical fluctuations which destroy the phase A or phase B, just depends on which direction we go. So that's the important, and that's what typically is called Griffiths-type transition. It's not driven by local physics. It's entirely driven by exponentially rare fluctuations which destroy one of the phases. By the meaning that, well, okay, in this phase you can find inclusions which have different physics than the remaining piece. So this is Griffiths-type transition. And then, okay, well, now I complete the theorem, it says the following. If you have a gapped state, fully gapped state, the only way how a fully gapped state can go and become gapless is through the Griffiths transition. There is no other way out. Because if it's not Griffiths transition and you have a line, which depends on the model which you use, well, then it has to be gapless, according to the previous statement. So the only way you can exit out of the fully gapped state is through the Griffiths type transition. There is no other way out. And it goes through the scenario of generating rare fluctuations when you mimic some regular field destroying the phase. Well, for the Mott insulator, this would mean just, well, increase the chemical potential above the gap, you'll dope it. So this is not an assumption, I just see no way out. It has to be of the Griffiths type. Okay, well, that's what I mean by the Griffiths transition, just, well, because this will be relevant for the discussion of what will happen experimentally. So you just sit in this phase A, you slightly change the color of this phase as you approach to the critical point. I'm still finite distance away, small but finite. I go on another side, it's also small but finite distance, and I see no difference whatsoever between A and B. They will appear identical on a short scale. Well, if of course I increase the point of view, I'll see that, well, actually B is different from A, though locally it's the same. It has some regions which actually are distinguishable from the rest of the phase A. For example, this is Mott insulated, but this is doped region. Has an extra particle or extra hole. Of course, if I start moving away, those regions will become more frequent, smaller in size, maybe they will start overlapping, and ultimately you go to superfluid. But I have to go through this stage. So that's how it will happen if I go, say, from Mott insulator to any other phase, which is next to the Mott insulator. But this brings me to another statement. Even if those lakes are superfluid, the whole state is an insulator. Because I can exit Mott insulator only by the Griffiths scenario, and Griffiths scenario implies rare statistical fluctuations when large regions are exponentially rare. You cannot establish phase coherence between them. It cannot be a metal or a conductor. So which says, okay, any phase which you have out of the fully gapped state has to be an insulator. It cannot be a superfluid. Just because I can exit the gapped state only by the Griffiths transition, then state which is right next cannot be a conductor, because those lakes are completely surrounded by the fully gapped state. You cannot conduct under those conditions. Okay, so this brings me to the set of conclusions, which I summarize here. And the most important ones are that, okay, all transitions between gapful and gapless have to be of the Griffith type. And then you see that superfluid motor insulator transition is simply forbidden in any dimension, because motor insulator is fully gapped. So the phase right next has to be an insulator. It cannot be a superfluid. So you have to claim that, well, there is some intermediate phase between the two, and there is no way out. It will always happen under any circumstances. If you look for the transition between fully gapped and superfluid state or conducting phase, they will be always separated by something else. Just superfluid motor insulator is one particular example, but this will work for any other system between fully gapped and conducting. I'll probably just mention that, well, okay, regarding the phase which you have next to superfluid, because superfluid is a gapless state. So the state right next, if it's a generic transition line between superfluid and something else has to be gapless. Well, if I actually have disorder in the chemical potential and I have no particle hole symmetry, well, you create a piece of superfluid in state B, which is an insulator, but you can always fluctuate to phase A, which is superfluid. So I have superfluid lakes, and I can shift their chemical potential back and forth in a finite window. This immediately gives you finite density of states. So I have always a compressible state if there is no particle hole symmetry. Well, but if your disorder is not in the chemical potential, for example, it's in the hopping or interaction for the quantum rotor model, I have to have a phase which is definitely gapless, but it can be incompressible just because I don't have this flexibility of shifting the grid of energy levels up and down. It's fixed at the same value. So if I have particle hole symmetry, actually, I can get another glass, which is called, say, mod glass, which is gapless but incompressible. Well, that's another possibility. But if it's a disorder in the chemical potential, I always have this one. OK, now I just go back to the kind of prime subject which I was interested in. It's a disorder at Bose-Hubbard model. So we have bosons on the lattice. They couple as usual. And I have disorder in the chemical potential within a certain bound. I will concentrate on the case when the occupation number is exactly one, so I have more insulator on the phase diagram. So what did we know? Well, I will not discuss, OK, when you have superfluid or more insulator. This was discussed many times. So those are the pieces of information we actually knew for sure, and mostly from here. We have every single statement which was correct. But some of the statements were extremely plausible, but they were kind of conjectures. For example, Griffith type transition between motor insulator and Bose glass. Yes, I believe it 99.9%, but it was kind of the conjecture. Now we know it's for sure. It's a theorem that it has to be of this type. It was also conjectured that the most plausible phase diagram, and you have lots of arguments why this has to happen, that Bose glass has to be always present between superfluid and motor insulator. But the problem which we had was that, well, numerical simulations found a direct transition. Immediately, a set of theoretical papers appeared explaining that the direct transition is possible. And I will explain later that, well, what will happen tomorrow is that experiments will see a direct transition. But the theorem says, OK, it's not allowed. So the initial conjectures are extremely all correct. So the Bose glass will always interfere between superfluid and Mott insulator. But once we understand the physics, how this happens, you understand, OK, why this will be seen in the experiment. And I'll just comment about this a little bit later. No, the theorem is a theorem. It cannot be wrong. You don't believe it, you prove it wrong. So the theorem is right. So you have seen the assumptions. So Bose glass will always interfere in the middle. Well, I think we pretty well understand what happens in the weakly interacting Bose gas. So it's definitely an infinite slope. This is for three dimensions. If it's 1D, if I recall correctly, it's 3/4. But in 3D, this is pretty sharp law. It's interactions to power 1/4, which is almost a vertical wall, how it goes up. And we also know one peculiar fact from simulations done by Kraus, Trivedi, and Separli, that if I start from motor insulator and increase disorder, I actually can stabilize superfluid. So going along this line, I can actually get a superfluid. I'll just right now present a couple of arguments that, well, OK, in 1D and 2D, we understand how this happens. In 3D, you actually have to run the simulations to confirm this is true. But it appears to be true in all dimensions. And OK, we also want to establish the global phase diagram just to see how it works. What are the typical numbers for the experimental verification of the phase diagram? OK, so the theorem more or less says, OK, that's how it has to happen. But we have to understand the shape here. And we have to understand the shape far away when this order is strong.
Is it really a phase transition or a crossover between B, G?
Every single line is a phase transition. Well, this one?
Yeah.
It's a Griffiths transition, as I explained what it is. You will not see it in the experiment. Because on any scale, at this line, you need 1 per second, and you will not distinguish this phase from this phase. If you move a little bit further, further, and further, ultimately, maybe it will appear on a scale of 1 centimeter, if you're lucky, in the experimental setup. Yeah, I'll make a comment about the experiment later. So that's the true thermodynamic phase diagram.
I have a problem, but look, if they can look really on the single atoms level, then maybe they can see these blobs of superfluid.
No, I'll come to the experiment later. Well, this is a theoretical statement about thermodynamic limit. Well, let me just first mention that, well, if I do the conventional Harris criterion, it basically says, okay, well, I have to compare correlation lengths in D plus 1 with 2 over D. But if I'm interested actually in the transition at the tip, I have to modify the standard Harris criterion. The standard Harris criterion is pretty simple. You say, okay, suppose I have disorder in the chemical potential. So this is the typical disorder fluctuation on some scale which is set by the correlation volume. So that's how the chemical potential will fluctuate inside the correlation volume. And then you say, okay, I would like this fluctuation to be smaller than the distance to the critical point in the original model. If this is much smaller, then likely disorder is not relevant. And that's how Harris criterion is written. Well, at the more insulated tip, I have to modify it because, well, fluctuations in the chemical potential are related by power law, how you actually close to the critical point, because more insulated tip has same vertical derivative at the transition. So I have to convert from chemical potential fluctuations to fluctuations of delta U using ideal relations which I have for the tip. And then I see that looking for fluctuations being smaller than the distance to the critical point, correlation length drops. And essentially I see, okay, Harris criterion can be violated, but only in D equals 1 and 2. And in 3D looks like I'm doing fine according to the Harris criterion, but not according to the theorem. It will have, Bose-Glass will interfere always. So the Harris criterion is done, doesn't telling me the entire story. It simply says, okay, in 1D and 2D maybe yes, but not in higher dimensions. And there is actually, well, another argument which allows me to maybe calculate the shape of the phase diagram close to the tip in 1 and 2D. It's just to consider what is called Euclidean superfluid hydrodynamic section. Well, it has a wave. The second piece is nothing but conventional XY model, but there is also the first piece. Well, this is, for example, written for 1D because I am considering space coordinate X, and Y coordinate will be C tau. So I'm talking about ground state in 1D. Well, so it's ultimately two-dimensional, space and time. So I have this term which looks like two-dimensional XY model. So the relevant fluctuations are vertex anti-vertex pairs. Well, what this term does, though it looks like a full derivative in time, well, because phi is defined between 0 and 2 pi, I may have multiples of 2 pi coming from here. And you immediately see that vortex type configuration changes this number by 2 pi. So I'll just not bother you too much with this kind of explanation. Well, it simply says the following. The only difference from conventional to dimensional XY and Coriolis-Taurus transition is that vortex pairs have a complex phase. So when you write down the contribution of the vortex pairs to the statistics, you have to give them a phase. And the phase is simply counting how many particles I have between X1 and X2. Well, you see that, well, if I start separating vortex pairs, that's the nature of the Coriolis-Taurus transition, the phase factor for the pair will grow, and ultimately it will kill contributions of pairs which are separated by too much in the space. So they will try to stay vertical. And if pairs are vertical, they stop renormalizing compressibility, they will renormalize only superfluid stiffness. So I go to a phase where superfluid stiffness goes to zero, but it's still compressible, because my vortex pairs are vertical. All of this was understood well before. I am just repeating the mechanism.
You have 3 minutes.
Yeah. So the ultimate conclusion will be, OK, that's the shape of the phase diagram. That's how it goes. You have more insulating gap in 1D. And disorder, which will stabilize superfluid, is only square root of the gap. So it's extremely sharp phase diagram. And tiny amount of disorder immediately stabilizes superfluid by killing more insulating physics. Well, you can run the same argument in 2D because it's the same action, nothing has changed. Now, instead of vortex pairs, I have vortex loops. So the phase is the projected area. You count how many particles you have in the projected area. You do the same argument. I have to rush a little bit, but I'm saying, well, it's the same physics, but you're in higher dimension. And you come up with the answer which says, okay, relevant disorder is only a logarithmic function for how close you are to the critical point. I'm sorry, it has to be u minus uc here. It has to be the difference. So the phase diagram is actually almost a vertical wall, how it shoots up. So this is kind of some generic law with the critical exponent close to 2/3, but this one is a vertical law. But still it predicts that disorder stabilizes superfluid phase. In 3D, well, you do the simulations. I don't have a good argument just explaining why disorder will stabilize superfluid in 3D. So this comes from simulations, just confirming the earlier predictions. Well, but now we have the phase diagram, and yes, Bose glass always comes in and interferes between the two. What is a little bit surprising is that if you do it on a big scale, first, tiny interactions. Interactions here are just so small, we cannot even just, well, measure how small. It's extremely small. Na cube may be 10 minus 5. Disorder is 100 hopping. So it's already, I don't know, 10 times bigger than the bandwidth. And it's already superfluid. Tiny amount of interactions immediately stabilizes superfluid against disorder. So actually, well, I was always thinking that, okay, Anderson localization without interaction happens when disorder is roughly the bandwidth. Here you go maybe 60 times the bandwidth, and it remains superfluid. And only then, okay, things turn around, you go down. But on top of the Mott insulator, you also have enormous numbers. Like disorder has to be 60 times hopping. Mott physics is already also on a scale of 100. Well, Mott insulating transition happens here, so it's already in hundreds. This is also close to 100. It remains superfluid. So, okay, you have huge fingers with outrageous numbers. The superfluid is fragile. If I plot superfluid density along this direction or this direction, it actually drops to pretty small numbers. But it's still superfluid. No matter that numbers are small, it's still superfluid. Probably I'll leave this for the questions because, well, there were questions how it will look experimentally. That's what I think will happen experimentally. You'll see a direct transition at the wrong place, and the fingers will be cut off. And there is another puzzle which I would like to mention. This is for the speckle potential. That's the one which was already discussed with exponential distribution of the amplitude. So if you do the speckle potential, and all parameters are tuned to be roughly typical, what you will have for localizing one particle in the potential well. So the correlation length of the speckle was roughly one particle per well. Scattering length was much smaller than the size of the well. So density was very low. And what's puzzling is that, well, you cannot destroy the superfluid temperature, transition temperature, in this weakly interacting Bose gas. If you have Na cubed 10 minus 4, the transition temperature, okay, it drops, but maybe barely 20% when the disorder potential measured in proper units. Remember that LC is roughly interparticle distance. It's already on a scale of 10 to 14. If you try to do theory, second order perturbation theory, and later Carlos Sedimelo told me that he went to higher order and the result didn't change, the theory says, okay, it has to drop and very sharply. And actually, in the region where you already have very sharp drop, numerically you see nothing. So essentially, the theory which was done for the same Na cube cannot account even approximately for what's happening in the realistic system. So I would say just, well, it's a total failure at the moment to understand theoretically the suppression of TC in the interacting Bose gas by disorder. Well, not to mention that for fermions, we're also kind of in complete disarray how TC will depend on disorder, especially when you approach Anderson localization.
Questions. So there are these ideas of creating a disorder also using two species, that you freeze one species in random positions, which is then a kind of Bernoulli binary type of disorder for which the assumption of your theorem are not valid because the probability distribution has zeros. Still, it is the limit of something which you said. This,
well, then
what can you say? Is there any hope?
I would say, yeah, just assume that you have a function which has zeros, and I allow myself to modify this by 10 minus 10. If you claim this is a fundamental change in the physics, then I agree with you. But if you think, well, this is probably a minor change in what's happening, then we're back to the statement. Because you have to understand that, well, okay, well, you have to claim you have a binary solution, but then I say, okay, in this binary solution, what if I fluctuate in the number of particles? You have typical fluctuations. But I can create atypical fluctuations in the particle number distribution. Say they cluster together, or they create spherical shells, anything you want, because it's finite probability to happen. And if you claim that the transition point does not depend at all on how you distribute your atoms around, then it's probably one statement. But if the transition point does depend how you distribute atoms around, how you introduce two-body, three-body, and 10-body correlations, you are back to the same. Because I need any dependence of the transition point on the disorder properties, any properties of disorder.
Okay, I have a question here, Nicola. So if I move from the mass state vertically up, you're saying that for genetic distribution, I will have to go through the Bose glass before entering the superfluid,
yeah.
Right? And once I cross that phase boundary in the Bose glass, you have a small probability of finding the incompressible sites that with the gapless local.
Okay, well, here I have the cartoon which I was showing before.
Yeah.
Very close to this line, Bose glass on a local scale is indistinguishable from the gap Mott insulate.
Right.
And it's distinguishable only by searching for rare spots where Mott insulate is doped.
Yeah.
It's particle or whole layer. All of this was understood well before.
Right. But if I try to appreciate your theory more. If I think about a very singular distribution function with a delta peak at the edge of the distribution function, then in principle I can close this gap between the superfluid and the Mott insulate, can I?
Yeah.
Then I don't have to go through the Bose glass. Say if I have a delta peak at the edge of your distribution.
Oh, no. Because if you have just delta peak, next delta peak is in the opposite direction. You cannot say you just close the gap by having a delta peak. If you have no disorder, which means everything is just one value plus delta, it's the same as homogeneous chemical potential. We're not talking about this. If you have plus or minus delta,
okay. So
if you reach this point, nothing helps you. You see more insulin.
Okay, so you do allow.
You have to go to a ray region where everything is plus delta, plus delta, plus delta, plus delta.
You do not allow.
And we go through the Bose glass.
You do not allow those very singular cases. Okay.
No. The average has to be zero because I will attribute average to the global chemical potential.
Yeah, but I can have a delta peak with strength 50%.
Sure. This will not help you because it's only 50%.
Yeah, but every other side I close the gap, and then they can hop.
No, you close the gap, but by the Griffith scenario, that's how you close the gap.
Yeah.
So it's the same physics, same picture, nothing changed.
Nikolai, could you show back the other picture? Yes. And so here you have finite temperature effect. Yes.
Yeah, this is finite temperature because superfluid density is so small in the fingers that if you have finite temperature. The transition temperatures here are also pretty small. So if you have finite temperature experiment, it will cut off fingers at first, because transition temperatures here are tiny.
Okay, so how do you understand the red dots? Is zero temperature?
No. Dots are zero temperature phase diagram, which I was showing before. And I say, okay, if you do finite temperature experiment, roughly with temperatures available today, I'll see probably this. Okay. I'll cut off the fingers, and I'll see direct transition at the wrong place.
What do you mean, wrong place?
So it will be superfluid, Mott insulated transition directly, mm-hmm. but at disorder strength, which is probably twice as big as the gap. That's what I mean, wrong place, because disorder is already twice as big as the gap, but you see direct transition superfluid, Mott insulated. So that's how it will appear experimentally, because, the volume of the system is not sufficient to play rare statistical fluctuations. They will not happen.
More questions? No.
Could you go to the diagram where you showed how the phase transition, this is when you were proving your theorem, where the phase transition line is vertical in the space of all possible disorder models. You know which one I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Right, okay. Now, I want to understand what this means, because what I don't understand is what is the meaning of the strength of the disorder as I change the model for the disorder.
Well, like for example, this one has dispersion. One dispersion.
Yeah.
So it's mean square fluctuations of the random number. This one has a twice maybe as strong dispersion.
Yeah.
This one has tiny dispersion. And typically you'll say, okay, what will I be typically seeing on a given site? Here, most frequently you'll see something very small, close to zero. Here, typically, I will see something which is, I know, 0.5. Here, typically, I will see something which is the almost the maximum value. So this is probably the strongest local disorder.
Yeah.
This is a weaker one. This is tiny because most frequently, this is 0, 0, 0. You barely disorder anything. From time to time, yes, you generate something bigger, but frequently, you have a lot of zeros. So it looks like it's a much weaker disorder. But the transition
right.
doesn't care about it.
Right. So the thing that is common about all of these different distributions that gives them all the same delta is that they're non-zero for all values of epsilon
that's
up
right.
to delta.
Yeah.
And so as long as that's the case, then this thing
that's
is going
right,
to
yeah.
be is going to be vertical,
yeah.
regardless of how small
that's right.
it is.
Plus, you can include correlations between the sides. You don't care.
And of course, this is only true in the thermodynamic limit.
Yeah.
So that if I took the first one, for example, and then I took that pedestal and made it small, then if I made it zero, of course, it would violate the conditions
yeah,
of the
Yeah, it will
theorem.
Be a smaller bound then. You are sitting simply here.
Yeah. right. And so, but you're saying that in the thermodynamic limit, the fact that it's non-zero, even though very, very small, is always going to make that
yeah.
transition vertical.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's why for experimental verification, I would say Griffith-type transitions, they are not measurable. It's the statement which you make academically, but you're not going to see it in the experiment.
Okay.
You have to move find a distance away to start seeing this physics. You will see anomalous fluctuations from shot to shot at some point, when those rare regions will start fitting the size of the system.
Okay, let's thank Nikolai again. And our last speaker for this morning session is Brian DeMarco. And the title of his talk is Disordered Insulator in an Optical Lattice.